Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is crime writer Alison Bruce, here to talk about her new novel, The Moment Before Impact. Ashley Meggett discusses his debut novel, The Dark Chorus, and we hear from the musical group The Drift about their collaboration with poet Nancy Gaffield. But first of all, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Alison, but welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you.
And we're talking to Ashley later about his debut novel, the excitement that there is when your debut novel comes out. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. It wasn't my first book because I'd written Cambridgeshire Murders first. So I had my excitement in instalments because I was excited when Cambridgeshire Murders came out, and then Cambridge Blue came out and that was my first novel. But the first novel I'd written was actually the one that came out third in the Good Hugh series. So I remember it was that evening when I had the real I've had my first book published moment, even though it was my fifth book by then. That was when I had that real excitement, actually. And it is then that you can look back at when you first had the idea and think, oh, what a journey it's been. And I think every author has some sort of unique journey attached to their first book coming out.
And had you always wanted to be a writer?
No, I think mostly I didn't know what I wanted to be. I remember at primary school being asked, and I said I wanted to be a pathologist. And whoever I was talking to kind of shrank back a bit and went, ooh. I think I was probably watching Quincy at the time. So I think there's always been an interest in crime and what else is behind it. I'm still interested in things to do with pathology and everything else. So I was probably right when I was about 8 or 9. I just didn't pursue it. I suppose over the years, it's just been general interest about anything to do with the police and psychology of people.
And do you think it's harder now for debut authors than it was back then?
Publishing's doing really well. With lockdown and everything, a lot of people have taken the time out to read when they haven't done for a while and rediscovered the love of it. I think there are more opportunities to market now. When I first signed for Cambridge Blue, there was a little clause in there that mentioned ebooks, but it was very much whatever that is, you know. And obviously now people have multiple platforms where they can be published and be read. And there are opportunities with self-publishing that have become quite reputable rather than going back a few years, it was just really vanity publishing. And there are more authors coming through the self-published route and then being taken on by mainstream publishers than there were a few years ago. I think my word of caution is if you are going to self-publish, you have to think about the quality of the cover, the quality of the editing, and how you are going to market yourself to reach an audience.
Well, let's hear your first choice of music now, which is G by The Crows. But first of all, is music important to you, Alison?
It's incredibly important. I really love all kinds of 50s music. Not really keen on the whole crooners thing or any of that, but certainly a mix of 1950s music, rock and roll, rockabilly, doo-wop, 50s R&B and so on and so forth. Yeah, it's been incredibly important throughout my life, and I quite often play music when I'm writing, and it might be one track on repeat for days on end until I've done justice to that particular scene or section that I'm working on. I think it does open your mind up to imagery and different energies and things like that. So I can't imagine writing without music.
And why this one? Why G by the Crows? What's the story?
G by the Crows is accredited as being the first rock and roll track by some people. I'm not sure if that's right, but this one never ceases to give me goosebumps and give me a little buzz.
Love that girl. Oh, 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 oh,
that was G by the Crows, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Alison Bruce. Alison's first crime novel, Cambridge Blue, published in 2008, introduced us to her detective DC Gary Goodhue and her trademark Cambridge setting. She went on to write a further 6 Goodhue novels. In 2013 and 2016, she was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Daggett in the Library Award. And in 2017, she was longlisted for the third time. A year later, she published her first standalone novel, the psychological thriller I Did It For Us. In October this year, her second standalone came out. The Financial Times called The Moment Before Impact Alison's most accomplished outing yet. Ellie Griffiths described her as at the top of her game. And Ian Rankin said, Alison Bruce always delivers. Her latest is tense, twisty and terrific. Well, I enjoyed it very much too. So it's very nice to be in such good company there. And before we talk about that novel in particular, Alison, why crime? You talked about having an interest in pathology earlier on and being drawn to that area. Why?
I had a few ideas for different stories. The first one I wrote was the one that came out third, The Calling. And it was that story that really resonated with me when it came into my head. I wanted to kind of explore it more and I became really immersed in it. And I thought, well, actually, people always like crime novels, so I'll make my first book a crime novel. And then I've dabbled with writing other things since, but I always end up murdering somebody, normally within the first 10 or 12 pages. So I don't know if I've chosen crime or it has chosen me.
You just can't help yourself. You end up with a dead body. So. Writing a standalone, this is your second standalone as opposed to writing the Good Hugh series. Does that feel very different in a way? You've got a blank sheet of paper, but that can be a bit scary as well.
It's a big plus and a minus. Obviously, if you start writing a police procedural series, then every crime that you want to cover with the next book needs to be something that the police would investigate. It has to be more from the police point of view. Whereas with the two standalones, I was very much involved in the characters who were right in the thick of it and seeing it from their point of view. The Moment Before Impact is written in the first person, and that's something I couldn't have done with the Good Hugh books. But you're right, when I do start a new one, then I haven't got that outline structure of a team of characters that I already know really well and certain procedures they're probably going to follow. It's just really a blank page. So with The Moment Before Impact, it just started with a single image, actually. It came to me this week that it's a little bit like Schrodinger's cat in that we are in the car with the set of characters at the beginning and it's about to crash. And the people who are not going to survive the crash are sort of simultaneously dead and alive at that moment before impact. And I thought that was a really vivid starting point for a book. And then it ends up going off, as you know, in all kinds of directions. You know, it does give you the freedom when you write a standalone to go somewhere that perhaps you couldn't with the series. I'm very much a foot in each camp, but the next book I'm writing is the first book in the new series. So give it a couple of months, I'm going to be going, oh, I see all the plus sides of writing a standalone now as I'm battling with a new set of series characters.
And it is only just out, so some people might not have read it. So we should say briefly what The Moment Before Impact is about.
The Moment Before Impact is the story predominantly, there are a couple of other kind of main characters, but predominantly it's the story of Nikki, who was driving a car when there was a catastrophic crash. And you meet her about 3 years later when she's trying to put her life back together. And she sees across the road somebody who is the brother of somebody who died in the crash. And in that moment, she realises that it's not all what it seems. And there's something else that has to be revealed.
And then it starts to unravel. And the crime scene that you described there, the crash,
yes.
And going back to that, obviously years have passed, but I love the way you go back to that and unpick every element of it. And it struck me that in a way, that's a kind of zoom in on what you do on a larger scale in most crime novels. The scene is very important, but here it's crucial, isn't it?
It is. And I did spend a lot of time. I've got a pathologist that helps me with research quite a bit. And we spent a huge amount of time going backwards and forwards, looking at different scenarios and whether or not it was possible, for example, for her not to have been driving. So different injury situations, seatbelt injuries. I did a huge amount of research on seatbelt injuries. And then eventually it came together as it currently is. But it is quite accurate, I think, in its depiction of what occurred. When I go for things to do with pathology, I always look for case studies where I'm not actually just making stuff up. I'm actually looking at the case study and saying, well, that type of event would have had those type of injuries and that type of outcome. So it is based on detailed research.
Yes, as the book went on, it was almost like watching one of those, when you see crash test dummies tested, you know, then there's in slow motion, but with five people in the car, you obviously knew exactly where everybody was moving.
Yes, I saw it in my sleep quite a few times as well. Ian Rankin said it made him slightly uncomfortable, and I took that as a compliment.
Oh yeah, I think that's a compliment. And of course, it's in Cambridge again, where your traditional Cambridge setting. You don't have to set stories in Cambridge. I know you're based in Cambridge and near Cambridge, but why do you choose to? You could make somewhere up or just go somewhere different.
In the first place, it was a slight accident in that I did consider making up a place. And I decided to rule that out because I knew quite a few authors were doing it at the time, you know, making up a location. And I couldn't find an advantage to it. My theory was I would never make up somewhere that was as layered and as detailed and as unique as a real place. And secondly, I would no doubt trip myself up at some point. You know, it'd be like a giant game of Sims, wouldn't it? And I'd be eventually going, oh, I've just moved the school. And to me, it made sense to go to somewhere where I could actually walk the streets. But then, of course, the other advantage I realised when the books came out was that people love reading about where they live. So I picked up a lot of readers who I would have missed out on if I'd just invented somewhere. When I'd moved up here, I already had the first book part written, and it was set in the West Country where I used to live. And I thought, well, if I'm relocating, so is the book. So I looked around the area, you know, there's Bury and there was Newmarket and there was Ely. And I thought, well, perhaps Ely is a bit on the small side if I'm going to write more than one of these books. Newmarket, it's probably got to feature horses most of the time. Bury St Edmunds, it's got a lot going for it, but Cambridge is better known. Then I thought, well, look at Cambridge, and it's got so much variety, so many extremes. You know, you've got the old side of Cambridge, but at the same time, you've got the research side. So you've got the very old, but the cutting edge. You've got a whole range of people, locals, and, you know, the constant churn of the student population and tourists. And it is hugely recognisable. And the first agent I approached said to me, oh, you made a really good choice with Cambridge. He said, the American market is really important. And the Americans only know four places in England. They know London, Scotland, Oxford, and Cambridge. So that's why I went for Cambridge, really. But when I was growing up, I lived in Swindon, about 30 miles from Oxford. I'd always grown up with this understanding that Oxford was nicer than Cambridge. So I didn't come up here super pro-Cambridge, but I was here for a very short length of time before I realised that I prefer Cambridge to Oxford by miles, actually. I think it's a lovely, lovely city. And I hope that comes through when I'm writing. The locations I use in the books are places that I've walked and I've spent time. I usually walk around quite a long time before I pick a location. In the latest book, it's Mawson Road, just off Mill Road, the Hot Numbers coffee shop. You know, I spent a few evenings in there and their fantastic hummingbird cake. I thought I'm going to give that a shout out in the book. And Celia, one of the main characters in the book, enjoys her hummingbird cake, as I do.
It's always great to read a book that's set in Cambridge. And for Cambridge 105 Radio, it's very, very local. I think there's even a scene outside where our studio is near the cemetery.
Absolutely. I did walk through. You've got a gateway into the cemetery there, haven't you? So I was deciding which way to go in and out of the cemetery for that particular scene. I did end up right on your doorstep. And I just love that part of Cambridge, actually. It's not the first book I've set there. The second book in the Good Hugh series, The Siren, I spent quite a lot of time in the cemetery then. And I think it's sort of one of the wonders of Cambridge, actually.
Do you ever worry, because it's set in a real place, that people are going to say to you, you know, you can't walk that distance. You've had taken 5 minutes to walk from there to there. You can't do that. And you can't see that when you sit there. And that's not just around the corner.
There is the odd thing where I've taken a slight license. So in the Good Hugh series, he tends to look across to the police station. It really depends what time of year and how many leaves are on the trees, whether or not he can see from his flat. But I let myself off with that. In general, I've always walked the routes. Occasionally, I haven't walked the best route. And once in a while, that's been pointed out to me. But I've walked the way I would have walked if I was going there. In Cambridge Blue, I wrote a scene in Trinity Street at 1 a.m. So I thought it was appropriate for research that I went there at 1 a.m. and the character was by herself. So I went there by myself and it ended up being a really creepy experience because she gets to the corner of Trinity Street and Rose Crescent and she's actually murdered, you see. In the end, I left quite quickly because I was finding it a bit nerve-wracking, but it was the right thing to do because a location changes so much according to the time of day and the time of year and everything else. So I always try to go to the place that I'm writing about at the right time of year, in the right weather if I can, just because you can observe things more clearly than you would probably imagine them yourself.
I guess it's not just about the bricks and mortar, is it? It's about the atmosphere and the feeling of a place at different times of the year and different times of the day.
Yes, totally. And observing people. One of my favourite observations was on Parker's Piece, there are a series of benches around the perimeter. They should all be identical, but one is different. And the one outside the police station, the grass is more downtrodden. It's patchy in places. And there tend to be cigarette ends and bottle tops there. And it's just where people have been waiting for people inside the police station. And so you can't find out or observe things like that unless you actually go. So to me, seeing something like that is a treasure. It's kind of a special moment because I'm observing something about the local area and about people's behaviours that definitely add to the description and to the story. I'm very lucky to live so close to where I'm writing about. And I do admire writers, you know, who say, set their books in Egypt or Istanbul or somewhere without having the opportunity to go there on the day. I mean, they might have done quite a lot of research, but to be able to go, actually, I'm going to go there right now and have a look is a really good position to be in.
Well, particularly now, I would have thought during lockdown when people can't travel to the destinations that they might have picked for their books, you still can. You still can walk into town.
Yes, and I did spend a day in the summer actually just taking lots of photos in the centre of buildings that I've never been able to see before without lots of people standing in front of them. So I had a sort of clear run of photographing different alleys and back streets and everything in a completely empty state. So I thought that was a bit of a treat, actually.
A silver lining. Thank you, Alison. We'll come back to you in just a minute. But we're talking about debut novels earlier. Let's hear from Ashley Maggett now. He was head of IT for a Cambridge college before retraining in psychology. The Dark Chorus is his debut novel. And when I met Ashley at a cafe in Cambridge pre-lockdown, I asked him to tell me what it's about.
So The Dark Chorus, the overarching story, is about a boy who comes to realise that he contains within him the last shard of the shattered soul of an angel. And that's actually quite difficult to say. And his purpose, if you like, is to cleanse that soul of the evil that shattered the soul in the first place. And to do that, he has to collect the corrupt souls of the living. So the premise is that he goes out effectively to kill bad people, collect their souls, feed it to the shard to cleanse it and restore the celestial being back to, I guess, heaven. I never really say where.
So that sounds quite dark.
Yes, it is actually quite dark. That story is the vehicle for the real life stories that sit underneath it. So you might say that's the angel's story and the way at which the protagonist goes about collecting the corrupted souls is through ritual killings. And so, yeah, it has a pretty dark theme.
And it sounds like you must have had to invent some kind of religion for this.
Yep, I invented a religion called Banuism. And if you like, I used a historical religion called Manichaeism. It's a very old religion and it has bits and pieces that we know are missing. So I kind of filled a bit in and created this idea that a religion would go out and spend its time cleansing the shattered soul of this angel. And that's happened through the centuries. And there are religious artifacts that the boy finds to help him in his deeds.
So how would you define this book? What genre is it?
It's genre crossing, I think. It's a psychological story. Is it a thriller? I suppose it is. They do kill lots of people and they get chased, hunted down by police, hunted down by alt-right gangs and paedophile gangs. So probably it's quite surreal as well. So there's quite a lot of out-body experiences that go on. And because the story escapes the protagonist's mind and pulls other people into his story, literally they get pulled into it. I suppose you could say it's quite surreal as well.
And given that it is quite dark, how dark did you go? I mean, when you're writing this kind of darkness, it's quite challenging to you as a writer, but also you're aware of the effect on the reader.
I went pretty dark because when I was constructing the story, I needed the protagonist and needed two assistants, if you like, because the religion, when I thought about it, required it. And they needed to consist of pain and rage. And so in order to get sort of young people in that, who are in those states, we had to think about what they would be in. So yeah, I had to visit cases of, in one case, in the young girl's case, V, sexual abuse, actually at the hands of her father and her friends, his friends rather, wealthy friends. And I had to visit the idea of hate through a boy called Maka, whose father is a right-wing gang leader and who he blames for killing his Asian mother. So I had to call up those scenes. So child abuse effectively is quite a main theme of this.
This isn't for the faint-hearted then, Ashley, is it?
No, not really. I kind of don't dwell on that in any particular detail. Funny enough, the most difficult scene to write from this was where the boy himself is being abused. I don't go quite there. It sets off on the abuse and it's interrupted and so on. But I found that actually quite a horrible and personally challenging scene out of all of those to do. So, you know, yes, killing people is quite horrific and we do it ritualistically in the story. The abuse bit I found the most difficult to write. So, yeah, it isn't for the faint-hearted. As a reader, you might be challenged by that, but I can assure you, as a writer, I was definitely challenged by it.
So psychology plays an important part in this, and your background is in studying psychology, so that was quite helpful, I would imagine.
Yeah, recently I've got into psychology and I'm studying it. So, yeah, that came to the fore when I started thinking about how the police side might work, if you like, or the hunt might work. And I thought what I needed to do was have a psychologist in there so he could explain some of these things to the reader. Because I wrote the story in first person present in The Boy, I realised that in order to explain it, I had to bring somebody else in. So I brought in a psychiatrist and I wrote that in third person past, just to be a completely different voice. And that allows us to explore a little bit about the boy's psyche, really.
So writing in first-person present is quite challenging because your narrator only knows what they know in the here and now.
Exactly. Some people would say that that's actually easier to write. I'm not sure I find that's the case. But when you do write in first-person present, you do have to consider how you're going to get some aspects of the story over to the reader. And to be honest, when I started the novel, it was all in first-person and just from the point of view of the boy. I never named the boy in the story. He has no name. And then I had to think about, actually, how do we tell the story? How do we explain certain things? Like, how does the religion come about? Because the boy is following this religion without really knowing that. He has a part of a celestial being in him, right? So we assume that perhaps he's being directed. He doesn't know this. So we have to have some way of telling the audience, telling the reader, that they are actually following the protocol of an ancient religion. So, yes, first person present is enjoyable to write in, but limited.
And we're chatting now in a Bantu in Cambridge. A Bantu, not maybe this one, but it's played a role, hasn't it, in the writing of this novel?
Yes, it certainly has. So when I was finishing a novel, I would spend some time at a Bantu in Bourne, the original one. Lovely place to sit and write, great environment. You can go for walks there because it's an art centre. And I absolutely love, like a lot of writers, writing in coffee houses, endless supply of caffeine, date cake and egg on toast.
And what about Cambridge itself? Does Cambridge feature in the novel?
Yeah, it does feature in the novel, briefly. At one point, the psychiatrist is trying to find out about this religion. She starts to understand it exists. And of course, we have to go and visit an academic because Bantuism, if it did exist, would only be studied by probably two people in the world. And one of those was at Cambridge. So I have the psychiatrist, Dr. Eve Rhodes, and she comes up to Cambridge to visit an academic who is quite irreverent towards the academic world. And because I worked in that world for quite a long time, I could have had some knowledge of people like that. And interesting enough, just referencing back to the last question about coffee houses, she meets the academic in what was Clown's coffee house up the road, where I, because I worked at Cambridge for a long time, I used to go there and drink two or three times a week. So yeah, I do use Cambridge to that extent, but that's really about it.
And tell me a little bit about the journey to publication for this, because you're published with a small publisher. How did that come about?
I mentioned that I sat and wrote the novel in a Bantu. I was doing that because I'd started the novel as part of the MA here at Cambridge at ARU. And when I moved on to do some other training, an agent was interested in the work and said, could I finish it? So I sat and finished that. So that got me through the novel because I was for a deadline. Unfortunately, they then decided it wasn't for them. So that kind of floundered for a bit and it sat around. But what I did was actually a bit serendipitous. I was on Twitter, picked up a tweet by somebody about a independent publishing company called Darkstroke. And like a lot of us who are writers, I sent something off, not expecting actually a response, and got a response within a few days. And I think 10 days later, I had a contract. And as we sit now, we're staring at the cover of the book. So there we go.
And what's next for you?
Writing-wise, what's next is I have started my next book, which is called The Colour of Morality, and effectively about somebody who has moral synesthesia and can see morality as a colour. Much like the first book, there's lots of disturbed psychological elements to it, and we'll see who's at the end of murderous attempts there. There'll be some villainous things. I'm probably going to go down the modern-day slavery, I think. So they'll be the ones to get it in the neck or wherever they get it.
And The Dark Chorus by Ashley Maggett is published by Darkstroke Books. We're talking today on Bookmark to Alison Bruce about her new novel, The Moment Before Impact. Ashley there, Alison, talking about going to some dark places. You must have gone to some dark places in this novel, particularly towards the end. It gets very dark.
I've just completed a degree at Anglia Ruskin in crime and investigation, and we had some lectures that were fairly dark, actually. I realised that when it actually got to anything that was particularly dark, people on my course leant towards the screen. You know, we all leant forward. And then I noticed the reaction from people who weren't doing the same course was to sort of recoil slightly in their chairs. So I do think I'm drawn to that kind of thing. And I think a lot of crime writers are, actually. It's a fascination.
And when you're writing it, though, how do you do it? It's because you want to make people uncomfortable when they're reading it, which I did feel uncomfortable when I was reading it. So is it uncomfortable writing that?
It's not comfortable or uncomfortable. I would say that if I'm visualising the scene correctly, I'm so enmeshed in the scene, I'm almost writing what I'm seeing and I'm not aware of my imagining it, which, you know, in a sense makes it more real, but I'm just recording what I'm seeing in my head. So it's not a question of being uncomfortable. It's just a question of the words keeping up with what's going on in my head.
Well, to move to the light now, to talk about your heroine, really, your detective, Celia Henry. So she's a woman, she's a journalist, she's Jamaican. All of those are choices to make about your main character. Why did you make her all of those three things?
I had this idea of Celia, really. She came to me as a character. She wasn't a journalist, but she came in every other way. She came to me as a character, quite well developed. She just popped into my head and I really liked her. Warm to her as a person. So she's been in the wings waiting for her moment for a while. And then I thought how she would sit in this book as this woman who she takes Nikki in. She's lived in Mawson Road for years and she's seen the kids in the road grow up. And then obviously some of them being involved in this terrible accident. And she takes Nikki in despite Nikki being the cause of the accident. The opportunity to have her in that role just fitted with her character perfectly. So it gave me the opportunity to introduce this woman. I made her a sort of semi-retired journalist. She's gone from being a news reporter to writing kind of puff pieces for magazines and kidding herself that she's not really interested in getting behind the story anymore, but she really is, because it did give her the right contacts and the right sort of observation skills and everything. It seemed to work really well. And I am very fond of her, and I like the idea of featuring her again, but there aren't any plans to do that at the moment, but I would happily go back to her. She was a really nice character. I liked her very much.
Yeah, I very much warmed to her. And I wondered, because she sees things in the investigation, the police investigation, that they didn't see at the time, and you acknowledge at certain points that she's actually ahead of them in the current investigation. Wonder when you do that, is that an implicit criticism of police practice, or is that just the kind of convention that your heroine is always going to be ahead of the main guys?
Well, there wouldn't be any point of writing it if she was always behind. You have to be in the shoes of the person who is ahead. She has the advantage of knowing the people involved, and it's probably that more than anything else that gives her the edge, because, you know, it's all right to find somebody guilty of something when you're just faced with a set of evidence, but if you have a broader picture that gives you a sort of different slant, then you do have an advantage, don't you? It's not a criticism of the police. It is fiction, obviously, for one thing, but, you know, things do happen where the police have acted upon all the information they had at the time, but more information comes along later. And in this particular book, it's probably only Celia that is, for a moment, in the position where she can see more or have access to more than the police do. The fact that she picks up on that is a compliment to her, not an insult to the police. And she runs with it. And then it actually opens the window on something that nobody knew was going on without giving too much away.
No spoilers. Thank you, Alison. Well, let's hear your second piece of music now, which is Little Bitty Pretty One by Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. Why this one?
I just think it's enormously uplifting. I mean, I've gone on about being dark and all of that, but, you know, I do like music that makes me smile. And I think Frankie Lyman was a great talent. He would have been 12 or 13, I'm guessing, when he recorded this. It's one of those The Sun's Come Out songs. Mm-hmm.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Join me, Neil Jones, every Tuesday here on Cambridge 105 Radio for the very best from the world of rock. Every week we'll bring you big name interviews, all the latest from the local scene here in Cambridge and the very best rock songs around. It's 2 hours of rock every single Tuesday from 9 o'clock with me, Neil Jones, right here across the city in South Cambridgeshire on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
CKLG Accountants are a friendly team of accountants and tax advisors with big firm expertise.
I'm Sarah, one of CKLG's friendly tax advisors. Creating and preserving wealth is an aspiration for many of our clients. In our complex world of changing legislation and family circumstances, we listen and provide you and your family with bespoke tax advice tailored to your needs.
To find out more, call us on Cambridge 810 100 to arrange an initial chat with one of our specialists. Or visit our website, cklg.co.uk.
CKLG Accountants, your partner in business, your partner in life.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspiration.
And on Bookmark today, we're talking to Alison Bruce about her new novel, The Moment Before Impact. How do you plot? Because there's a lot going on here, lots of different character stories. How do you keep track of all that?
The trick, I think, for me, is to plot. Pantsers do it by the seat of their pants. I'm not one of those. I tried it and I ended up writing probably about a third of a book that had to go into the bin, because by that point, every character had a watertight alibi and nobody had a good reason for committing a murder. So I was totally in a corner. So I realised the benefits of plotting. I normally plot down to about 100 steps for a book, and then I'll write notes on each of those so I know who's in the scene, why are they in the scene, when it's occurring, what other scenes it relates to, so that I can look at the plot and read through the plot and make sure that I can be confident that everybody's in the right place at the right time doing what they're supposed to be doing. One small thing early on that's not right can have these massive ramifications later on, and you end up writing another book's worth of changes to try and unpick and re-sew everything. And the other thing is, it's nice to be confident when you're writing. And if you're writing and you're a bit tentative because you're thinking, I'm not sure this is heading anywhere, and you're writing and you write some perfectly good, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 words that are perfectly good, perfectly publishable, but ultimately lead you down a blind alley, you've got to throw that away. And that's really quite painful. Whereas if you've written a scene and you know, for example, you have a scene that starts with your main character going into a room and finding a mobile phone on the table, okay? And then at the end of the scene, they found the person whose phone it is. So you know where the scene starts, you know where the scene ends. You can go in there, you can use all your imagination and creativity to decide whether there's one other person in the room, 20 other people in the room, what sort of environment it is, all this kind of thing. Be totally creative. As long as you arrive at the right point in the scene and leave at the right point in the scene, then you can be confident that the scene is there for a purpose. So I find it a much more positive writing experience to plot intensely and then just write it.
And you must always be aware of what the reader is taking from the things that you're saying. You're second guessing what we're going to latch onto, and you're giving us red herrings. So the reader is always there in your head when you're writing.
Always. And there's a saying that says, you know, write for yourself first and then for others second and to get published third, I think it is. And, you know, some writers will say they never think of their readers. I always think of my readers. There's certain bits where I'll type something and I think, ah, somebody's going to love that, because it's like leaving a trail of little gifts. And I know there are some readers who will read and not second guess anything. They're just letting the story unfold in front of them. But I have to be thinking about the readers who are, like you say, going to try and unravel it all. So I think you have to think about a crime plot in three ways, kind of simultaneously. And if I was to try and write down how this works, I couldn't do it, but I know it works. Firstly, you've got to think about what you are telling them is happening. And then you've got to try and work out what they think is going to happen. And then there's what really happened. So it's got one plot, but it does three jobs. And you have to be aware of those three jobs all the time. Otherwise, the worst two things, well, the worst of all, is to make a reader feel like you've cheated them. You can lead them on a merry dance, but at the end, they've got to think, aha, that's not fair. You never want them to feel that it wasn't fair. And the second thing is, you don't want them to feel as though it was spelt out for them on page one, too early. I did solve a book on page 12. I've still got the book. I wrote on page 12 who the killer was going to be. This is before anybody had been killed, and why. And then I had to read the other 300 and something pages, hoping that I was wrong. And then page by page, feeling more depressed as I realised that I was correct. And it was the last book of that author I read, because I'd beaten them so conclusively. Not I had an inkling, I just sussed out the whole book. So you don't want to do that to a reader either. So hopefully keep them somewhere in that middle ground where they're not entirely sure what's going on, but they're not going to feel too bamboozled.
And everything has to fit in. We don't want a kind of stray, an odd conversation with somebody just happening, because the reader will start to think, oh, why am I being told that? Why is this person saying this?
Yes, I think it's something you get better at as time goes on, because, you know, when you're first writing books, you're thinking, well, there are clues that don't lead anywhere much. But you have to sort of open up all these ideas and then close them down neatly until what you're left with is the final answer in as clean a form as possible.
Thank you, Alison. Well, let's take a slight sidestep now. The musical group The Drift are comprised of Darren Pilcher, Rob Percy and Amelia Fletcher. Rob and Amelia also perform as the Catenary Wives and were founder member of the bands Tallulah Gosh, Heavenly and Tender Trap. On this project, The Drift collaborated with poet Nancy Gaffield. Nancy's first collection of poetry, Tuxedo Road, won the Alborough First Collection Prize, and her second, Our Ware, won a Templar Poetry Award. In Continental Drift, published in 2014, she explored place and our evolving relationship with the land, themes central to the work Wealden, the result of her collaboration with The Drift. And when I spoke to Rob, Amelia, Darren and Nancy via Zoom, Rob explained how the collaboration came about.
We were organising a festival, poetry and music, here in Rovenden Lane, where we and Rovenden, where Darren also lives. And Darren and me and Amelia had already started playing as The Drift, which was an occasional improvisation around a genre which we've decided to call marsh dub. By that, we mean it's quite bass heavy, and Darren creates atmospheric sounds, often creating loops out of organic materials which are derived from this landscape. So it's kind of, it was an unusual thing we're already doing. I met Nancy because we wanted to get a poet called Stephanie Burt to come over to the festival, but we on our own couldn't afford it. And so I knew that Nancy worked at the University of Kent in Canterbury in the poetry department, and I thought they might want to join forces to help us together. We might be able to afford to get Stephanie to come over, which we did succeed in doing, and it was great. But when I met Nancy, she talked about the poem she just had published, which was a poem called Meridian, which was about traversing an English landscape. And given that our music was derived from our own impressions of our landscape, which is the marshes and the Weald and Dungeness, one thing led to another. And so I suggested we might want to see if it was possible to combine the two. It was harder work for Nancy because she had to go and do all the walking. We just sat in our room and made a lot of noise.
And all the writing.
And all the writing. So that's how it came about.
First light protracts you like a bruise on the bank. Pushed up from the sea. Pushed up and driven by wind and wave. Widdershins.
I'm a walking poet, so it was something that I actually enjoyed. The first part takes in the high wheeled landscape, which is basically woodland. I had walked around some of that landscape when I did Meridian, so I already had some notes and some work done on it, but I also did a little bit of walking around that area. And then I decided on a kind of structure of 7 sonnets with broken lines, and each line of a certain number of syllables. I wanted to call it inscape, which is a word that means a kind of contemplation of an object, a scene, or an event. And so it's really kind of intensely observational work on that landscape. The first meeting, I brought along those poems, and Robin, Amelia, and Darren had already played around with some sounds. So, you know, we kind of got an idea of how we could merge those two together. That was inspiring, and it gave me confidence to go forward, having that soundscape in my head, writing the other two sections.
Broken boats, tangled rope, longshore drift, the great dying.
I like the sonnet structure because I think sometimes it's useful to work with a constraint when you're doing something new. But these particular sonnets are not so contained as a normal sonnet in the sense that the lines are broken and each half sort of steps down. So it's a kind of innovative type sonnet, but the constraint worked very well in terms of the kind of scene. Each poem is a kind of scene within the landscape.
Took the background noises that I'd recorded down on the marsh, and also we'll just go into a room, we'll walk into Rob's little studio and we will record a bit of the ambient noise in the room. I'll throw in some natural material, we'll find some reeds, we're working on Dungeness for example, and I found a handful of gravel. I love the way you can extract melodies from just a dropped handful of gravel that can be slowed down, reversed, syncopated with other noises, and suddenly you've got a magical loop that seems like a strange syncopation that you'd never logistically come to, which is what I love about this kind of happenstance loop work. You add a wonderfully thunderous dub bass to it by Rob, and suddenly it becomes a lot more listenable. And suddenly, we were all in a room, Nancy Gaffield walked in and started speaking over the top of it, and it sounded wonderful.
Not silence, but constancy. An unpleasant hum. That time, an approaching plane. The sound mirrors, already obsolete before the war, and after, a tourist attraction. Take nobody's word for it. They keep stumm, with a strange rhythm. Stumm.
Ironically, we were looking to find a really intrinsically Kentish sound. Rob found a poet who was writing about Kent anyway. She happens to have a wonderful Americana folkloric tone to her voice, and it worked the charm.
Papyrus followed by paper. Shift from stone to bronze to iron.
I love being able to play a bass line, the same bass line for 10 minutes. It's not the sort of thing any of us normally wants to hear, but when you're combining it with Darren's ambient sounds, the bass becomes the anchor and it allows Darren and then Amelia to throw other sounds around without the whole thing falling apart. There's no drummer. Some of the noises Darren makes are rhythmic, but it's not like a consistent drum kit. So the bass has a sort of different job. And once we were working with Nancy and I'd read where she was at, I would usually try and think of the bass line that would give it space and give it form, a musical form alongside her form, that would then create the spaces within which the things that Darren and Amelia are doing could sit without it becoming too inchoate or messy. So the bass gives the tempo, I suppose.
And a lot of it was in response as much to Nancy's words as to the landscape itself. So I typically use harmonium and clarinet, partly because they are really breathing instruments. They just feel very human. They somehow do convey the local landscape, but I'm not quite sure why. I think just because it feels very real and alive.
We talked a lot about strata. The poem, it struck me, was about the strata of history and of geology, because the landscape we're talking about has a fascinating history over the last 1,000 years. It's a new landscape, and it may not last much longer. It's one of the things that fascinated us about it. But the strata of history and human habitation of it, and then lost to the sea, and then reclaiming from the sea, we felt that analogy of strata made sense in musical terms. But that's what we were laying down, were layers, of which the voice was the top layer.
Old life equals the age of fish. Middle life, the age of reptiles. New life, the age of mammals. The cormorants swim low, skim the surface. So close, the green of their eyes. Bound to the land and bound to leave it.
It has been really interesting that the people that I think who have loved it best have been the people that have been to the marshes and also to Dungeness. It evokes everything that they remember and love about that area. So I'm just incredibly proud that we've managed to somehow convey in music and poetry that love that people have for the area.
When we did play it live, there were people in the audience, a couple of them were in tears, which surprised me because it's not a piece that's striving to be emotive.
There's no songs now that reference our local area. We live in a global world, and I think it's lovely to hear a few local references once in a while.
I really hope that we get to do it live more, the four of us. We're going to make this film so that we'll probably try to organise some little online premiere of it, which will hopefully get it to more people.
One of the messages I would kind of like to take forward from this piece is a kind of reflection on living simply in the natural world. And it's more important now than ever. I've led into a sort of a new piece of work, which now is being called Extinction Diaries, and it's focusing on different plants and animals and species which we're losing, and reflections on those. So that's where my work is going.
Wheeled In by Nancy Gaffield and The Drift is available as a pamphlet and CD from longbarrowpress.com. And audio recordings are available from skepwax.bandcomp.com. We've been talking today to Alison Bruce about her novel, The Moment Before Impact, which is published by Constable. Alison, what's next for you then?
I was working on a third standalone novel, and then I ended up in discussion with my publisher, and we decided that it would be good to do another series, a new series. So I came up with a character called Ronnie Blake, and she will be the main protagonist in a new series, again set in Cambridge, featuring a missing persons unit. So I'm re-plotting the first book so it becomes the first in the new series that will be finished early next year.
So when you know you're writing the first of a series, you're putting storylines in there that can open up and expand.
Yes, and also there has to be enough of a dynamic between the series characters to make sure that there's some development space for them, and that they're the sort of characters you want to keep reading about.
And what are you reading at the moment? It's a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark.
I'm currently reading Dead Ground by M.W. Craven, and it's not out yet. I'm reading a proof copy. He's an author of some great crime fiction. Very exciting, fast-paced, very entertaining.
Thank you, Alison. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but a heads up that our next show, it's a Christmas show, and we'll be chatting on that show to Cathy Moore, director of the Cambridge Literary Festival. She'll be looking back on the literary year and the challenges of running a literary festival during a pandemic. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Alison, which is 50s Pinup by Cy Cranston. Why this one?
Cy Cranston sings very much in the style of Jackie Wilson and some of those singers from the 50s. I like this track, and it does to a certain extent explain how I feel about 1950s music, and it makes me smile.
Killer heels for all your killer stepping, super girl saw this door.